Welcome to Red Meat, a collection of the tastiest tidbits from Odyssey's conservative news talk radio stations across the country, a place where we're not afraid to dig in. Today, we're going to take a second to cry in millennials, which sounds like the whisper of snowflakes hitting the ground. Okay, I'm joking. Really, we're going to talk about the housing market. A new report this week shows that prices in the U.S. continue to rise, making it increasingly difficult for Americans to afford homes. Over the past 5 years, the median price for an existing home is up by more than 42%. That's about twice the rate of inflation. And there's the mortgage rate, too, which remains high. According to Freddie Mac, the average 30-year fixed-rate mortgage is 6.75%. The income needed to qualify for a mortgage on a median-priced home in the U.S. is around $117,000. Take that in. Your salary has to be into the six figures to buy an average house. And in California, it's much higher at around $213,000 in salary required to buy a median-priced home. Is it time to give up and just tell the next generation to buy the avocado toast? So that's where we are, but let's kick things off with a little bit of history about how we got here. Here's Tara Servatius reporting from the end of the Biden administration on what was going on.
The Democrats taking a victory lap on, hey, we got inflation down. Okay, well, no, you didn't for housing. 7.8%, that's staggering. It hasn't budged in a couple of years. So for housing, that's it. Unless you're stuck in a house because you can't buy a new one because you got that 2-3% interest rate on the house. You can't buy another house. Well, you're gonna go 6-7% interest. Good luck with that. And this affects people both in the rental industry, if you're renting, or you're trying to buy a new home. I mean, the middle class has just been absolutely priced out of a new home. Shock ensues, I'm sure, every month when people have to re-up their rental. And they're looking at the lease and their mouth is hanging open. I mean, I was a landlord for a very long time. My husband's in real estate. So, I mean, I follow this. The real estate industry is all but dead because people can't buy houses and they can't get out of what they're in. And the problem landlords are having right now, and it's a big problem, is that these interest rates are so high, they have to pass it on. They have no choice. So, I mean, you're just, and those who have older rental properties that are still at the lower interest rates, they're, because Joe Biden's interest rates are driving the price of rent, they're jacking too to keep up with the market. It's just, it's insanity, and nobody's talking about what this is. I mean, I'm wondering long term, seriously wondering long term, like my husband.
So, say you don't live in California. What's it like in the rest of the country? Still not good. The real estate market in Michigan is holding up better than the national trends, with prices rising around 6-7% and sales slightly up, though inventory is tighter due to homeowners locked into low mortgage rates from the COVID era. The market is shifting towards more of a buyer's market, with more homes on the market, price drops, and less competition. Though affordability remains a challenge. Here's WWJ Radio in Detroit with more.
What they did was refinance, and they're at a 3% rate. And when you look at, you know, a home buyer who maybe wants to upsize, maybe they want more space, but when prices are at record highs and their mortgage rate is more than double what they're currently paying, to get into the next size home for their family is it's a huge sticker shock on the jump in monthly payment. And we tend to think that rates around 5.5% would, or mid fives, would, you know, relieve some of that sticker shock and cause some of the people who have been on the sidelines waiting, that do want a new home to fit their lifestyle preferences better. We're thinking that rate would alleviate some of that pressure and allow them to, you know, make the jump and get into a new home. And of course, with those buyers sitting on the sideline, they're also sellers, right? Because most of the time they're going to buy a new home and upsize, to fit their needs better. And those homes would be great options for a lot of the buyers who are currently or waiting to get into the market. So it's kind of this catch 22 where we have, you know, we have a ton of homes that would be great options, but they're not hitting the market because those homeowners aren't ready to, you know, to take on the additional cost of a monthly payment to move into the home that they really want to be in.
You mentioned those people who are on the sidelines and maybe someone who has rented their whole life. What kind of advice do you have for those people?
Yeah, I think first start off with talking to someone like myself, a real estate professional who can come up with a plan and advise you on what you want to do to be in the best situation possible to get out of the rent hamster wheel. We normally recommend having our, you know, first time home buyers speak with one of our mortgage lenders that we partner with to kind of put together a plan and work backwards from first, most importantly, what can you afford every month? What are you paying now? Can we match it? And if not, what is an achievable monthly payment for you? And we can work backwards from there based on, okay, how much money do you need to have saved in order to achieve that monthly payment? And what home price are we looking at to match that monthly payment to it? And then from there, inventory can be tighter in the, in the median home price range. There's obviously more people that can afford that compared to a $1 million home. And there are less and less options with the prices being where they are. So definitely making sure you have a good real estate agent to guide you through the process, because there are a number of strategic techniques that we utilize for our competitive offers without necessarily just spending more money. There are a number of strategies there that we can use to increase their chances of getting their offer accepted in a competitive situation without just, you know, spending money, which we know is tight for most of our first time home buyers. Frankly, you know, especially in Southeast Michigan here, some fear over the economy, right? Our job reports is down. And whichever side of the fence you stand on politically, there's been some, you know, some concern and some shakiness around layoffs and job reliability, especially here with the big three in Southeast Michigan.
So, is it still a dream to own a home, or does renting make more sense? WCCO Radio in Minnesota dives into that question by talking to real people, some of whom are reveling in houses they paid less than $100,000 for a decade or so ago, and others who think that buying a house these days is overrated.
That is a ridiculous amount of money. And I'm, Lindsay, you're moving right now, or you're in the process of buying a house?
I have moved. Okay. The house has been bought. Okay. It's certainly around those numbers that you're detailing there. And the process of the house moving has changed in terms of like your bargaining power and what you
Absolutely.
Put in for an offer and
Absolutely.
How quickly the market moves. And so you're seeing, you know, a lot of homes that are a little bit more move-in ready mm-hmm. that are going for tens of thousands of dollars over asking just to get in and grab a piece of inventory because it's so short.
Mm-hmm.
So it was we missed out on a couple of houses. We ended up with a great one over in New Hope, lovely neighborhood and everything else. But in terms of the looking, the finding, and just how quickly things move, it's wild to see like that decision being made as quickly as it
yeah,
has
Yeah, you're
to
not
be.
Mulling it over. You're
no.
making it in 20 seconds.
And this is
seconds.
Where you're going to live. And this is yeah. hundreds of thousands of dollars.
The investment is something that you're going to be burdened with for a long, long
time. It's like
time.
Cosmic blackjack down at Mystic Lake. They're trying to get it as many hands in an hour as possible. They'll put the yin-yang twins on for you. It's a great time.
So we're in where I'm at in life is now I am sick of being a homeowner. I'm sick of mowing the lawn. I'm sick of shoveling. I'm sick of worrying about the roof leaking. I'm sick of it. I'm sick of every spare hour of every day going to maintain a house that I will never pay for. Unfortunately, because we've moved so many times, there's no way I'll ever pay off this house. It ain't like the old days. And I hope there are some of you out there in that situation where you're able to buy a house and live in it and pay it off. And that's awesome. That is that's the American dream, right? I don't think the American dream is that way anymore, and it's not realistic. It's too ridiculously expensive to pay off. How much money are you making to be able to pay off a $500,000 mortgage in 30 years? I know the money's not that good for everybody. It's tough. It's tough. And it's overrated. I want to sell the house. I want to live in an apartment. And I'm privileged to be able to have the money to buy a house, but it's nickel and dime. It's a death by paper cuts. The house thing is I'm not going to live here for another 25 years. It's just not realistic. And you know the prices are high right now, so maybe try to get out when the getting's good. So I want to be the guy to live in an apartment. I'm tired and done with it.
You won't mow, but you will pay an extra $300 a month just so the front offices can have a golf simulator and a living room that no one ever uses.
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yep. They upcharge you for all these, quote, amenities that no one uses.
I definitely do not like that. Don't like it. Don't like it. Don't like it. Have you done this? Have you downsized? Have you just changed your life when the kids leave and when they're gone? Or are you sticking around? You staying in that big house? Love to hear your comments. We've been getting some great feedback so far here today. I paid $98,000 for a nice small house with a large detached garage in Northwest Wisconsin 6 years ago. Right.
Cries in millennial.
I put $50,000 into upgrades in it. I love it here. Found a great job. I'm living the dream, I guess. $98,000 house? Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And could we live in places that are more affordable? Absolutely. That's another thing I grapple with that all the time. Number of first-time homebuyers is plummeting. Story that just came out today. Economists are always watching the housing market as a barometer for the health of the broader economy, and some see trouble ahead for first-time homebuyers if they can't start climbing the real estate ladder.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course. The younger buyers are already riddled with student debt. Mm-hmm. Don't get me started about higher education and prices and all that business. But so you're starting off your life, unless you're privileged and have had your school taken care of. And again, I'm not mad at you if that's your situation. I don't think very many people are in that situation. So you're a young person. You're graduating college. Your job's being taken away by AI. Your prospects are not as plentiful as maybe they used to be. And you now have to, the median price of a house you can buy in the Twin Cities is $450,000 or $400,000.
Does that make you believe in the future, Chris?
Well, listen, I've got kids and I'm worried about them. Mm-hmm. I don't know.
I would be too.
I think that maybe gets into this piece, and I'm here to say it, that the American dream and the house owning and the going to college and the this and that, whatever. Is that the right thing for everybody anymore? I don't think so. I don't think it is.
Is it feasible to climb out?
Yeah. And that's
really the question.
And that's exactly right. And that's what that article was saying with first-time homebuyers. And if they're not able to buy their first house, that means they're not able to buy their second house. That means the other person up food chain doesn't have somebody to buy their house. I mean, it definitely.
And real estate wealth is different when you talk about accumulating that money for you later on, whether that's going to be used in retirement or you're passing it down if you choose to have kids. That's
absolutely
another big conversation to have about these home buy. Like, you get all that. Now pay for a kid.
Right. Yeah.
The numbers don't add up. I'm not a math person, but ugh.
We stopped having kids at two. We had our daughter, and I'm like, yep, time for the surgery. I went to a guy named Dr. Snip, and that was the end of that. I'm like,
what weekend?
We can't afford
Masters? Or U.S. Open?
No, I didn't do it during the
March Madness.
I didn't do it during March Madness.
Okay, so
but that's the big cliche.
Sure.
Thing. Yeah. But I'm like, we can't afford to have two kids. It certainly can't afford to have more. All right, good comments coming in. I asked about downsizing. We downsized 1,000 square feet, two less bedrooms, one less bathroom, moved to a villa, has two levels, after being in a home for 20 plus years. Not doing yard work. Not there in one of those situations.
1,000
where they take
square
care
feet?
Of them.
That is a tight.
Less. 1,000 less.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Feet. Now, somebody else says we upsized. We lived in the North Loop in a condo and moved to a great house in Golden Valley. I'm just saying it's tough out there right now. And it's to think about what kind of debt that you need to go into in order to live the American dream. Talking about home ownership, the perils, the pitfalls, the joys. Brian is on the phone with Golden Valley. What do you have going on, Brian?
Hey, Chris. About 25 years ago, I paid $150,000 for my house. Two additions and a kitchen and a refinance at 3.5%. I still owe $150,000. I will be 83 by the time I get this thing paid off, if I'm above ground, as well as the fact of the matter is my insurance and my taxes went up. My house payment jumped $300 a year, a month now.
That's another thing, yeah.
I'm with you, man. I'd love to be able to sell and just rent. I could spend 3 hours a day on my yard and still not be caught up. I mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, it gets to a point you're like, what am I doing this for? The joy of owning the home is not there anymore. It's a burden.
It really is, and I don't know how I'll ever get ahead. I got a $20 a month pay raise, and my house payment went up $200.
Right, so like the math doesn't work very well, does it?
No, it doesn't, and my kid's going to grad school, so it's like I'm going to work till I'm 80 years old, for crying out loud.
I kind of feel like we're all going to be in that boat.
Interest rates are a big part of the issue, and President Donald Trump hasn't hidden his displeasure with Chairman Jerome Powell. When can we expect these astronomical rates to give us a break? Let's check in with Newell Norman at WWL Radio in New Orleans.
Welcome back, folks. We are joined by Guy Williams, president of Gulf Coast Bank and Trust. He joins us every Monday in the 12 o'clock hour. We talk about the international economy, national economy, local economy, all of the issues that are impacting our lives generally each and every day. And with that, Guy, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you very much. Great to be with you.
So, Guy, we had the open market committee meeting, I think it was, what, last week, and we passed again on a Fed rate cut. First time in a long time that a couple of the governors voted, they did not vote in unanimity. They had a couple of detractors, and so where does this leave us?
Well, it's an interesting spot. It gets more complex because one of the Fed governors is resigning, so the president will be able to appoint somebody else more quickly than expected. And, of course, Chairman Powell's term ends in April of next year. So you have an argument for continuing to hold rates stable and an argument for reducing rates. So the argument for reducing rates is it seems that inflation has dropped. But in the last month, the argument for keeping them the same, inflation has ticked up. Core's gone up a little bit. CPI has gone up a little bit. And the economists at the Fed believe with absolute certainty that tariffs are inflationary. They just feel that they haven't had enough time to work their way through the marketplace. So their fear is that inflation will come back. Now, inflation hasn't come back yet, but there's a genuine fear and a little bit of a tick up. So that's an argument on both sides. Consumers still spending. So that's an argument for keeping rates where they are. On the other hand, consumer delinquency is going up, which is an indication of stress for the consumer. Fed is always worried about asset bubble. And anytime you have super low rates, people tend to get into odd things. And we talked a little bit about crypto treasury companies last week. And these are companies where people are literally paying more by company stock than the underlying crypto assets that the companies own. So you're literally buying, you know, dollars and paying $2 and $3 to buy $1. And the Fed looks at that and says, this is an asset bubble. This is the sort of thing that will get worse if rates go down. So they're nervous about that. On the outside of reducing rates, you had a tremendous adjustment to the employment numbers. And Fed has a dual mandate to keep low inflation and stable employment. So the employment numbers would argue for reducing rates. And the labor market is getting tough. It's intriguing. You know, there are always different corners of the market and anecdotes, but one that I thought was particularly compelling is the market for PhD economists has suddenly gotten weak. Last year and the years before, 100% of PhD economists had jobs within 30 days of graduating. Now, a significant percent do not have jobs, and that market had been super stable, super dependable, and the feeling is maybe that's the tip of an iceberg of educated people not being able to get work. And so you have arguments on both sides, argument for reducing rates, arguments for keeping them the same. And as you say, two dissenting votes, the president will probably appoint somebody that will also want to reduce rates. I would be surprised if he doesn't have that discussion with his nominee. So that would be probably three at least reduce rates in the next meeting, if not more. So doesn't clarify things, but certainly more pressure to reduce.
So the real battle then, underlying battle that's going on here is that the tariff policy needs to reach some maturity level, both in the decision making by the president, because we have delayed implementation of certain, and I think we just recently delayed again. So that creates the uncertainty. There's a tail is what the Fed is saying, and they want to see what the impact of that tail is going to be moving forward. Unless and until we get there, they're going to be reluctant. The president, on the other hand, feels like, you know, their concerns are not warranted. But I guess we do know from past history that both could be right. Maybe not, I guess. I'm not so sure.
Well, we do know this for sure. Companies need to know what the rules of the road are. And passing the big, beautiful bill, setting the tax rates was one big step in certain. So that was very positive. Locking down the tariffs, wherever they may be, is going to be the next step. And it's critically important for investment, because you don't want to invest in something if you think that your competitors are facing a 25% tariff, and then you get midway into building a very expensive plant and the tariff gets reduced to 10 or zero. So certainty on tariffs is very, very important. And if I were advising the president, I would suggest that he ask Congress to actually vote on whatever the new tariff scheme is, so that people realize they're not going to bounce back and forth, whatever the new administration is, because for sure the president is term limited. So you will have a new president in 3 years. And it's tough to build a big manufacturing plant when you don't know for sure what the rules are. But yeah, putting in some certainty matters. The other thing is there are a lot of details that haven't been discussed. You know, the EU tariff at 15% with no retaliation is really a great thing for the U.S., except all 27 members of the EU have to vote to make that effect. So we think we have an agreement. You know, President Lagarde and President Trump both said that was the agreement they want. But if any member of the EU votes no, we don't have an agreement. And that's another part of uncertainty that's lying behind and underneath the challenge for U.S. manufacturers.
Well, Guy, we almost certainly know that France is not going to vote in favor of this, right? I mean,
probably not. I mean, they've been pretty vocal that they really don't like it. They're not in favor of it. Now, will they get pressured by the other members? Who knows? But yeah, if they vote no, Hungary's often been an outlier voting against the rest of the EU. You know, setting up the EU with an absolute unanimous vote, I think, was probably a mistake, because you can't get 27 people to all vote all the same way. I mean, if I got all the members of our family together for a family reunion, we wouldn't all agree to vote on anything. You know, you have to have some consensus and compromise, but getting every single person to vote the same way is really a challenge. So that puts the EU tariff in question as well.
And then we are faced with trade restrictions that we don't end up talking a lot about. I think you probably saw the article in the Wall Street Journal this morning relative to China limiting the flow of critical minerals to defense manufacturers here, you know, magnets and the like, that's necessary for so many different things that we do in the defense industry, but in other industries as well.
Yeah, China is definitely looking at what leverage they have to resist the U.S. You know, China's made it very, very plain. They want to have a different world order. They want to have another group of countries, Iran, Russia, China, perhaps India, if they can get them on board, to counterbalance the U.S. And their thought is, it's China's turn. And President Xi has said as much. He said, you know, for years we've hidden our strength and bided our time, but it's now time for China to stand up. And so they're using the leverage of the critical rare earth minerals to extract better trade terms. Now, we've hurt ourselves in a lot of different ways in this area. You know, we have access to rare earth minerals in Greenland, in Alaska, in Nevada, but we haven't granted permits to actually mine them. So we can solve this rare earth problem. China doesn't really have a permanent monopoly on them, but we have to make an active decision at the U.S. and look, this is important. We are going to grant permits. You can do mining. We are going to encourage exploration, even in states like Alaska that are primarily federal land. We are going to allow exploration in federal land, and also deep sea mining for some of these rare earth minerals, all of which would alleviate this crisis. But in the short run, China does have a strong negotiating position, and they're using it to try and leverage against the president on the tariff bills.
So let's get back to the ultimate question of reduction of the rate. The president wants, what, 2.5, 250, 300 basis points, 3%?
I mean, yes.
That's not achievable. I mean, and he wants that in one lump sum?
Well, that's economically unfeasible. Those rates occurred during the COVID shutdowns when the whole global economy was shut. And that's not occurring right now. You have, strong production. Despite the numbers, you're still gaining U.S. employment. So there's no way in the world the Fed is going to lower rates, particularly at that level. I can't imagine that they would lower rates more than 50 basis points, and I would actually be surprised if it's not just a 25 basis point decrease. One of the reasons they'd be very reluctant to do that is if there's a future problem, they don't have any runway left. You know, we've discovered during the financial crisis and during the COVID era, if you bring rates below zero, it doesn't really work. You know, the financial economy doesn't work with negative interest rates. You know, countries have tried it. Japan tried it for a while. Switzerland tried it. And it's really a counterproductive strategy. So if you lower rates that much, you've got almost no room if there's some problem, some economic thing crops up. You know, some of these odd bubbles, like the crypto bubble crash, you'd be very challenged to inject liquidity. So the Fed would not want to do that, and I wouldn't advise them to do that either. It would really be a sign of much more weakness in the economy than we're seeing. And I think that's a bit of the messaging that the administration needs to be cautious about. Super low rates are indicative of a crisis in the economy and some financial problem.
I like to divide these things up into comforting lies and unpleasant truths. And I think a lot of what the president is saying right now is really a comforting lie. Because I believe the unpleasant truth here is that, and I would love to know your thought on it, do we ever, in the near term, especially during his administration, get down to an interest rate level that we enjoyed during the pandemic? I don't think so, right?
No, that's an interesting phrase. Did you say enjoyed during the pandemic? Well, the rates were super low, and some people really did enjoy it. Home buyers loved it. Home sellers loved it. Savers hated it. People on fixed incomes hated it. But it was a symptom of a very weak economy, not just in the U.S., but globally. And there's some other big factors, and the Fed looks over their shoulder at the bigger factors. There's a demographic challenge globally. The population in the entire world is aging, so you have fewer workers. which means more people that are on the receiving end of public benefits. And that's a challenge. You also don't have a big push in productivity. Rates were able to go down for years when China came into the market as the super low-cost producer. Well, with tariffs on China, with Chinese workers making more, you don't have that super push to low prices. So there's some demographic challenges that are going to make this difficult. The other thing is federal deficits, not just for the U.S., but for a lot of countries around the world, are a real challenge. And when you create more and more government debt, you've created an awful lot of supply. And at some point, demand doesn't keep up. And the adjustment is a higher interest rate. So demographics and government debt are both pushing you toward higher interest rates, not lower interest rates. So it's tough to see how we would ever get back to those super low rates we had during COVID. And I don't think any of us want another global pandemic.
Yeah, so, I mean, you know, one of the things that frustrates me, obviously, the pro-Trump administration economists that are out there, we hear this talking about a 300 basis point reduction, trying to get down to the same rate as during the pandemic. And they're not really saying anything about it. I mean, it's just really not achievable. The more I read, the more I recognize that ain't going to happen. And it's certainly going to happen in the next 3 years. Unless something disastrous in the economy happens, another pandemic.
Well, and I think probably the way to interpret that is when you hear a Saints fan talking about the next season, what we all want as Saints fans is New Orleans to repeat the Miami Dolphins' perfect season and win the Super Bowl. That's our objective. Now, I don't, you know, Bobby Hebert is going to come on later and say we've lost our minds to even be thinking that way, but that's what we want. So what you want and what's real are two entirely that's different real. Things. And yeah. I think people are expressing what they want as opposed to what's real.
Yeah, so true, so true. Thank you for bringing me back down.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Red Meat. Don't forget to smash that subscribe button for your favorite tasty assortment of conservative audio. And follow your local Odyssey talk station to get shows from these hosts delivered daily wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, stay hungry.